You're listening to episode 32 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this interview, we talk with Mike Rodore. Running time for this episode is 54 minutes. There's a question that I'm going to go ahead and give my source here. I was actually talking to an artist by the name of Keith Curtis, who taught me this question. He says he tries to ask this everywhere he goes.
Why is that name familiar?
I don't know. He's done art for a whole bunch of role-playing products.
Maybe. Okay.
He also does a lot of cartography and such. So You've probably at some point encountered his name somewhere.
Sure.
Hero Systems in particular works a lot with. But Keith has this great question. It hasn't been appropriate in most interviews, but somehow it feels right for this one. If there is one misconception you could tear down about what it is you do, what would it be?
It's a real f-ing job. I have a real job. Oh, well, you work at the comic book store. That's not a real job. I manage 15 employees. I am the liaison between 4 store managers and their employees to the owners of the company. I don't want to get into bragging rights and numbers, but we bring in as a company not a small amount of money. And that's not to say that we're rich and Dave and Kel are buying a yacht, but I work, and I'm not kidding, I will work 5 days a week. I've worked a 7-day stretch just last week. I will work routinely 10 to 12 hour days. I negotiate leases. I pay bills. I argue with the phone company. I do payroll. I work my ass off. Now, what I sell might be, and everybody's like, oh man, he's getting serious. What I sell might be fun. I love comics. I love games, but I work just as hard as anybody else that has an MBA or a college degree, that has a job that's pulling down real serious money. I just happen to do it in a hobby industry. But this concept that we don't work is such a fallacy, and it actually pisses me off when I hear it.
Mm-hmm. I can feel you there. I really can. I don't work in retail, but right. I don't work in comics or anything like that. I encounter people like my mom or like my coworkers and stuff. And they're like, well, what are your hobbies? Right. You know, that sort of thing. Well, I do a podcast. I do a podcast on role-playing games. I play a weekly role-playing game and I'm into comic books. Oh, so, you know, kids stuff. And I'm like, no, uh-uh.
Table flip.
Yeah. I had a coworker. His big thing was cycling and competitive cycling. And he's pulled that on me. He's like, oh, well, you just do all that kid stuff. I'm like, you ride a bicycle. Come on now.
I'll tell you what. And we talked about this a little bit at dinner. I always correlate role-playing games to prostitution. But also to storytelling. And there was a time.
What are you looking at me for, Julie? I didn't say anything.
I don't remember there, this
like,
conversation.
Looks to me like a permission. Yes, you have a white cord vampire. We know.
The oldest profession is not selling your body for money. The oldest profession is telling stories. The oldest profession is the sharing of entertainment. And so as whether that entertainment is a novel or that entertainment is your ideas in the form of a board game experience, more importantly, comic books and role-playing games, which is the topic of your show, we do something significant that human beings have been doing since the dawn of language. And to diminish what that is, whether it's our hobby or not, is immaterial. To diminish that and say it's kids stuff or that it's unimportant by comparison. I mean, you want to talk about unimportant. You take your 300 pounds and you sit down and you eat fists of, you know, Velveeta and Cheetos while you watch a couple of other people do something, you know, for 4 hours at a time while you get drunk. That's childish. But to sit down and intimately share your imagination and to create things with people, that's way more interesting and far more mature, in my opinion.
Right.
But I'm just being a snotty elitist gamer.
I think you're right. I mean, if you look at the importance of story, myth, legend, whatever, to the entire fabric of our society, I mean, it permeates it at every level.
Right.
And, you know, I certainly do understand that athleticism and competition also fills a certain role within our society. But I certainly do agree with you in that one of the things that I have never understood about the elitism of people that are into sports is you're not playing the game.
Right. Did you see what we did last night? We totally won. I didn't see your ass on the field. Yeah. Well, you didn't do nothing.
That's my favorite thing.
Show me your Super Bowl ring.
Our team, our hometown team. Well, 90% of that team ain't from this town.
Yeah.
And you aren't on the field.
Maybe not this country.
Yeah. Yeah. It's rich people playing a children's sport.
Right.
That's great. There's nothing wrong with that, but Let's call it what
right.
it is.
Meanwhile, I exercise imagination, mm-hmm. math, creative writing, critical right. thinking, and I'm childish.
Yeah. Oh, and you do it in a social context right. with friends.
Right.
You know, it's.
Let me ask you a question, because this is something that varies from store to store. And I realize that obviously that's going to be predicated by available floor space. Mm-hmm. What do you feel is the importance or lack of importance regarding play space?
So let me preface this by saying, one of the best parts about the job is Dave is very, very open and encourages individuals to express themselves and to have a difference of opinion, assuming that that difference of opinion is well-reasoned and et cetera.
Right.
So Dave and I have had arguments that have been so loud and so full of profanity that people in the store can hear us fighting about stuff. And that's the kind of relationship I have with the man, is that if I believe in something and I stick by my guns, right. then, you know, he's happy to have me argue with him about it. And years ago, and he will not admit this today, but years and years ago, Dave and I actually argued about the importance of play space. And I've always felt, and he'll say that it's important now and that he does not remember this argument, but that a play space is important.
You're having, like, his wife.
Yes. Yeah. His wife, Kelly, is a saint. I mean, my wife.
You remember all the times he was wrong. Uh-huh. You're taking over his business and taking his money. You're deciding who he associates with. Holy crap, you're the man's wife. Exactly.
It's a sexless marriage.
Now that you've made it to the top, you don't have to put out anymore. So, you cut your hair short. Yeah. I mean.
But I think it's crucial. And I think it's crucial to our business model. And if you've noticed over time, even our smallest location, Maplewood's 1,400 square feet.
Right.
But Dan has three tables for people to play at.
And there's always people there.
Because congregation is important. So that's what we've done, is the tavern or the town square used to be where the people would come and they would sit and they would exchange the news of the day and they would talk. If our method is cultivating relationships, then the best way to cultivate those relationships is to have people be present. The best way to have people be present is to have a space for those people to hang out. And nothing sells a game like gamers playing it. So I think it's essential, even if you have a small play space, to have a place where people can come and exhibit the product that right. you sell for you without you paying them.
Let me ask you about that. I'm going to ask you to choose in a false dichotomy here, because I have no doubt that both are true. But I'm curious which one you feel is more true. Either A, the play space allows people that are not playing the game to see it and become interested in it, or B, the people that are playing the game but doing it on location during the breaks or when they want something will walk around to the store and buy it there. Which is more critical? Accepting that both are true, mm-hmm. which one do you feel is more true?
In my experience, I would say B. And here is why. Let's take Chad, for example. Mm. Chad can go online. He can buy a copy of the Skate book that's in my hand. He can read great reviews on it. He can get the book sent to his house. He can get it as a discount. But where does Chad play the game? Does he play at his house? Does he play at his buddy's house? What the promo space does in connection to the store, the promo space gives you a place to play that is safe, where you are going to be around people, that it is socially acceptable to be engaged in that hobby. So as opposed to getting it at the shop and then going home and playing with your friends and just feeling like it's only us that does this, by being in the game store, people can come, they can get what they want to get, whether it is dice, whether it's other peripherals, whether it's core rule books, they can sit down and they have a place to play where the people that are there in the shop, whether they're into that specific game or not, they're certainly into the hobby. They certainly understand. And those people feel like they're around individuals who are of a like mind, as opposed to feeling isolated, feeling alone, and like they're doing something weird or counterculturey or inappropriate.
Deviant. We prefer deviant.
Yes. So if they're doing something deviant, right? But also, it's wonderful in that sense of environment, in terms of people come to the store, they buy their games, they buy their chips, they buy their sodas, they sit down, they play their games, and the promo space gives them a reason to use the product that they've purchased, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
It's like buying a fancy car, but then leaving it under a tarp and only taking it out once a year.
Right.
Oh, hell no, man. I want to rent time on the racetrack mm-hmm. and just take that thing full throttle.
Well, and one of the cool things about that, too, at least from the store's perspective, is that if you have somebody coming and doing a game, be a card game or miniatures game or role-playing game or whatever, they come in, they play, maybe they bring their own book in, maybe they bring their own whatever in, and them and the players enjoy the game, get a kick out of it, have this really great experience in mm-hmm. the space, and then they get up and they see all the supplemental material. It's mm-hmm. right there, and the idea, the good feelings about it are fresh. Like I said, from a store perspective, that's great. From a customer perspective, I want the product.
Right.
I feel good. I want it. I don't want to wait or think about it. I just want it.
Just got your ass whooped by Sorcia. Sorcia's counter fig is right there on the shelf.
Right. Exactly.
What's she going
to
do?
Or to go back to the first aspect of the question, the idea that I have people in the store
right.
promoting the product for me is not equally important, but is still significantly important. And that's why I said earlier in the show that I'm a fan of visitors. If you want to go and you want to buy heavy gear online because I don't carry it, and you want to set up a beautiful table of miniatures and play a game of heavy gear for 3 or 4 hours on one of my tables, as long as you don't mind people coming by and looking at it and asking a question or two about the game or about the miniatures, dude, feel free. I'm mm-hmm. happy to have you advertise the hobby in my store. And so the promo space, what it does is it's not just random material on a bookshelf. It's actually something that people use for specific reasons and that they have a good time with.
So. I've participated in that. We have somebody would come up and run a game every once in a while in a game store, and I would go see him because I don't get to see him very often. Mm-hmm. And we were playing Firefly or Serenity. Mm-hmm. Role-playing game, and I had so many people come by and talk to me about it. It was crazy. Like, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, man, this really is free advertising,
right.
isn't it? It really is. And I mean, I've had it just in a store. I was in Barnes & Noble. That's mm-hmm. what we have now, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Borders is no more.
Yeah, Borders is no more. But I was just looking at role-playing games just to see what they had there. And I had some person walk up and like, do you play these? And I actually had like a 30-minute conversation about mm-hmm. how they should buy it because it's a great hobby and all this
right.
stuff. And yeah, it's very true. Gamers love to talk about what they love. And
it wasn't the creeper going,
oh. All right. I have to say, as a salesperson, as a retailer working in the store, what you just recounted is exactly my favorite thing about the job, aside mm-hmm. from talking about the hobby, is that I can't think of any other industry where I, the retailer, can walk away from this conversation and I have two people who love the hobby talking about the hobby. They're going to take this conversation and they're going to remember that it happened in my store, and you're doing the job that I pay this guy over here to do. So now he can focus on other stuff because you're doing the job that I pay somebody else to do for free because you love the hobby too.
Right.
Let's talk about the love of the hobby. Is part of your hiring criteria that people have to be into this type of stuff?
The short answer is no, but yes.
It's like no, but shaking your head yes.
So here's the thing. It comes down to product knowledge can be taught. I can teach anybody about Superman. I can teach anybody about Hellboy. I can teach anybody the basics about Dungeons and Dragons or the basics about 40K. What I cannot teach is the ability to communicate well with others mm-hmm. and the ability to be a genuine ambassador for the hobby. So I can hire somebody who has tons and tons of retail experience that doesn't really know the hobby, and I can, after interviewing them and working with them for a couple of days, can tell if they're going to work or not and they're going to be able to do this. But generally, you're not going to find people who are good representatives of the hobby unless they themselves are passionate about it on some level.
Because there's a lot to know.
Right.
I mean,
there's too much to know. You can't know it all.
I mean, okay, let's talk about other industries. Chad, you and John used to work in a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
You guys worked different sections. You worked in checking. Yeah. What did John work?
Well, he was a bagger.
He was a bagger.
And
okay.
then he moved over to
Denver. And I know you knew some guys that worked back in produce yep. and things like that. And obviously mm-hmm. each of them had things that they needed to know about their areas,
yeah.
about how to maintain them. And I'm sure customers would ask questions and they had to know things about the store and about the product. But there's a whole lot more in a D&D book than there is in a cantaloupe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
it's interesting, like you mentioned produce. Think about the produce section. It's like, well, how much can you know about produce without really getting into the horticulture? And if you're going to, are you going to hire a horticulturist to be a produce guy schlepping fruit? You know, obviously you can't pay them. And well, what they did is they were allowed to eat as much fruit as they want. Mm-hmm. I mean, they couldn't walk the aisles and gnaw on apple, but when they're when they're in the back room, and they were encouraged to eat 3 pieces of fruit a day, and they were encouraged not to eat 2 apples and a banana each day, but actually try all the different fruits and vegetables. So they get a new kind of baker potato in or something like that. Take it home, cook it up, see how it is. Meat guys, same way. Mm. And that way, the
grocery store.
Yeah, I know, right?
Free food.
The liquor guys got free samples.
Wow. I thought my boob job was going well.
But yeah, it's all kind of stuff like that. To be honest with you, I worked in more of an upscale grocery store. Mm-hmm. And
like a Whole Foods or?
No, not a Whole Foods. Dierbergs is where I worked. You know, not top of the shelf, but I worked in a Dierbergs in West County. So there was sort of a expectation of service there. And like our produce guys, they knew their shit, man. Mm-hmm. They knew their shit because they were able to.
Funny word choice.
Yeah,
they
lots of produce.
Their
and do their shit. Yeah, and lots of fiber. Yeah. And you know, that's our dietary fiber. But yeah.
We were given free bras.
Yeah.
Constantly. Like every time a new bra. The time. No. Every time a new one would come out, we'd get it.
Your job was just tits. I mean, I can make this work with anything.
It's interesting that you say that. We do encourage people. We have a library program where you can take product home and you can check it out. As long as you bring that product home in a week's time and that product is still in sellable condition, then, you know, you want to take home that new trade paperback for Morning Glories and read it. I want you to take it home and read it. I mean, it's your free time, but you're a fan of this stuff, and I want you to engage in product knowledge. We have at each of the stores a variety of board games that have been open through the years for demos, for displays, etc. We let the people check those out. If you want to take a board game home and play it with your friends and learn how to play it, that's absolutely wonderful, and I certainly want you to do that. My store managers, because the job is stressful and difficult and I want them to continue to be into the hobby, I give each of them $100 in store credit that they can use with their discount to purchase product. Mm-hmm. So I want to encourage them to be up to date, buying new product, mm-hmm. trying new things. And I want them to continue to be fans of the hobby.
Yeah. A good sale. And I say this because my dad is a salesperson, has been for years, and I picked up a lot from him. And John and I talk about sales stuff all the time because both of our parents are heavy duty salespeople and all the techniques are the same, even though they sell totally different products. Mm-hmm. But if you want to be a good salesman, you have to believe in what you're selling.
Right.
And to me, as a customer, I see that. Mm-hmm. I go into like a fantasy shop or anywhere. I love it when the salesperson is talking about multiple products and they say, this one, it's popular, but it's crap.
Right.
You know, I played it, I've read it, it's terrible. But this one, which is maybe not as expensive, this one's really good. Mm-hmm. And from what you've told me, I think you'll like it.
Right.
Why don't you check it out? And that is an excellent salesman because he may be talking out of his ass to me, but they believe in what they're selling.
Right.
And that gets me to believe in what
you want to get somebody really honest and also watch them squirm. And I've seen this only done a few times. Walk into a restaurant, sit down, and when the waiter or waitress walks over, ask them what the worst thing on the menu is. That suddenly changes the entire tenor of the rest of your dining experience. If you can get them to tell you, because you asked what the one item on that menu they would not touch is.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating to hear how they handle that.
I've had a server be like, are you sure you want that?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard them say which one they like more. Like you say, hey, well, I'm looking at this and this. Which one did you recommend? And I've seen the server say, oh, this one's definitely better. But that's talking one thing up, not talking another thing down.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, too. One of the things we encourage people that work for us is you don't have to like everything. And in fact, if you present yourself as liking everything, you're going to seem disingenuous to the consumer. So as long as you're prefacing it with, in my opinion, I don't particularly care for this because of that, or know your audience. So there's certain guys that if I'm talking to them on the phone, I'm like, dude, the game blows. And let me tell you why it blows. But other people would say, actually, you know, I've played it a number of times. I'm not mm-hmm. particularly fond of it. I prefer these types of games. But I don't want people to think that they have to sugarcoat things or that they have to love everything. And I want the consumer to know that I'm not just selling them product, that really what we're selling is the experience of the store. The thing where we have to be careful, I mean, you guys are gamers, and everyone listening to this show is very likely a gamer. And in our sort of subculture, gamers are very, very sensitive about their opinions. They're very sensitive about the things that they like. And what's interesting is that if you insult something that a gamer likes,
it's personal.
Yes. It's as if you are Monty Cook himself, who I think is a genius, by the way. But if you say, well, I thought the Book of Vile Darkness was blah, 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 and somebody who thinks it's great gets their feelings hurt. They got all butthurt about it. And I never understood that. You didn't write it. Why are you getting all bent out of shape? You know? Yeah,
they have taken it and opinion becomes identity.
Right.
And that's what it is.
Well, right.
And so if I think, and you see this because I like review movies and stuff. Oh, and okay. When I say like the movie Red, I hated the movie Red.
Right.
Hated it. Thought it was stupid.
Retired Extremely Dangerous. Did you read Warren Ellis's comic that it was based on?
No.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Okay. Yep. I did a review of Red and people were like,
bromance.
Oh my God.
Chaz has gone through the bro door.
That's right. No.
I have not heard that one. I usually get hoer.
I'll go through the bro door later.
Sorry. It didn't mean to derail you, but it was, you guys looked at each other so longingly, I couldn't pass it up.
I'm sorry.
So anyway, yeah, people took it personally. If they enjoyed the movie, that's great, because that is the point of the movie, is to you enjoyed it, you get the entertainment out of it. And I think that's wonderful. And it didn't work for me. But some people, and it wasn't as bad as all this, but for the example, they became incensed about it because they liked it and they adopted it as identity.
Right.
I am the kind of person who likes this. This says something about me. So when you say something about the movie, it says something about me, and it transfers onto me. So you've just insulted me.
And I agree with you. This is absolutely true of any interest, any hobby. I've seen people get personally upset over commentary on bands, sports teams,
I cannot have,
TV shows.
And I've told this to Wayne and some other people. I cannot have a rational discussion about Doctor Who. If you ever talk to me about Doctor Who, I will only say positive things about it. And if you start saying bad things about it, I will change the subject, because I am such an unabashed Doctor Who fanboy that I know about myself. I will take it personally.
Right.
And it's Doctor Who. It's a TV show. Why am I getting pissed off about it? It's like, for me, it's religion, politics, Doctor Who.
I will only say positive things about Doctor Who. I'm only like that with Rush.
Oh, so, really?
Here's the greatest rock band in the history of human existence.
Yeah, Geddy Lee,
that great song, YYZ. But,
table flip.
I think it is different within geek subculture for two reasons. Here's why.
Yeah.
One, because of the fact that it is a fringe culture, it is an identity that is not...
You said fringe.
Yeah.
I heard French, and I did not understand it.
I like fringe.
But now you say, now
I
that
too,
I understand
but I'm glad
fringe.
It's over.
Yeah. But it's such a fringe culture.
And I heard French again. I'm sorry.
I actually did that time as well.
It's such an fringe culture.
Yes.
That... I think people, especially depending on their age, depending on the culture they came from, may have had to suffer to hold that identity. And I hate to use the word suffer, but let's call it for what it is.
I'm that guy.
Yeah, they may
have 38 years old, and that's
may have been bullied.
True.
And so as a result, that culture is going to sit in a somewhat sensitive place already. Someone who says they don't like it is going to be subconsciously associated with a bully, with someone who is on the aggressive against you as a person. But I think something else that kind of figures into that when we talk about role-playing games is, let's go back to what Brodor was talking about earlier, which is the art of storytelling.
Right.
If you say that a role-playing game sucks, maybe I didn't write that role-playing game. Let's say, I don't know, Pathfinder, whatever. But if I have been using Pathfinder to tell my stories for the past 3 to 5 years, well, now all of a sudden there's a part of myself that I have invested back into that game, because that is not per se a game. It is the structure that creates a game. Mm-hmm. A Pathfinder rule book is a structure that enables me to tell certain kinds of stories. It's a toolkit. And effectively what you're saying when you say that toolkit sucks is by extension, on once again, some subconscious level, you can draw that out to say, well, anything built with the toolkit sucks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone builds a house and you look at their literal toolkit, and you say, wow, these are substandard tools. What have you just said about their craftsmanship, you know, of everything they have ever built? And so I think that there is perhaps a predisposition within our subculture. And I believe that all subcultures get worked up about crap they shouldn't get worked up about. But I think that there might be a predisposition within our subculture to be more sensitive to that. than most other subcultures.
Well, and I'm guilty of it as well. I mean, being a fan of the show, every time someone references being shaken, and I would respond to that comment, but I'm shaken. You know, I get butthurt because I love Savage Worlds.
Oh, I do too.
But
I just say shaken.
Yeah. And it's, I think it's a legitimate criticism, yeah. But I'm the same way, even though I know it's irrational.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love Savage Worlds.
But hating riffs is not irrational.
No.
No, I got to tell you that, you know, I'm a firm believer in that it's not the game system, it's the game, which is essentially right. The essence of what Dan was just saying. Except I think riffs is the exception
yeah.
to that rule.
Yeah, riffs really does.
Sorry, Kevin.
I thankfully never played it, so.
I've got it sitting right there if you want to borrow it.
No, yeah. As much as you
take $100 in store credit and walk home with that.
No?
$100 in Dan credit.
You take $100 of Monopoly money. I don't know. What do I pay you guys in? So, all right. Let me ask you a question. And I know that you could talk for hours on this.
Uh-oh.
Okay, so I'm just going to ask here for kind of a top view, kind of a flyby here on this one. Why do so many stores fail?
Let me preface this by saying I'm no holds barred, by the way. If you guys want to ask about finances, you want to ask about money, you want to ask about expansion. I mean, honestly, I'll answer anything. Dave won't care. But
does it burn when you pee?
Not anymore. But for the Zappa fans out there, my balls do feel like a pair of maracas. I've probably got the Gano Kakakakas. No, if you're a Zappa fan, you got that. Anyway, why do stores fail? Stores fail for, I think, two specific reasons. One, the people who run the stores don't take themselves seriously as a business person. They don't look at it as a business. They look at it as a hobby. So I have my job, and then the store is my hobby. And whether the store makes money or not, whether the store is profitable or not, whether I take the store seriously as a business venture or not, are all immaterial compared to my ego. Why I have the store is because I own a game store and I have status among other gamers. So it's not about having the biggest collection of miniatures. It's not about having the best painted 40K army. It's not about having the oldest condition, whatever issue of Spider-Man. It's about the vanity and the ego of this is my game store. This is my place. I'm the owner. They don't look at it as this is my legitimate business. This is my business model. These are my percentage breakdowns on where my money's going to go. This is my profit margin. And this is where I'm investing said profit.
Do you think those people don't know, don't care, or both about the business side of things?
I'm going to go with both, actually. It's interesting when you go to GTS, mm-hmm. the retailers that you see at GTS are the exception to the rule. The people that are there that take their business seriously, that want it to be their primary source of income, that don't want to work their other jobs or bought out their partners or what have you, they're there because they want their business to be successful. The subsection of that are the people that actually go to the seminars and listen to the experts in the industry talk. Those are the people that really want to see their business succeed.
Sure.
So the first step is...
Well, if nothing else to your earlier point there about the ego and the status, to go out to a convention, to sit down and take notes and listen to somebody, that right there is an act of humility.
Right. It's hard. It's hard. And Dave's been doing this for a long time, and he'll tell you that the only reason that he's good at this is that he's made every mistake that there is to make. And he's here to share all of his wisdom with you, because this is how I screwed this up and that's how I screwed that up. And don't make the same mistakes that I did. At one time, Dave was actually voted more influential in the gaming industry than even Gary Gygax, which that was a year where we carried around Dave on a litter. And anyway, but he's a wise man and he really knows business and he really knows this industry. But the lessons that Dave is teaching now, I could be selling shoes, I could be selling widgets, I could be selling bullhorns. It doesn't matter. What I'm doing, I can take those lessons, that skill set, and apply it to any business, any management position that I have. But most people who do this with gaming, the real failure is them, because they don't take themselves seriously. They don't see what they're doing as a legitimate business. How do you expect your clientele to, and how do you expect to succeed in business if you don't take it seriously yourself?
What else?
They don't care about being successful. They don't care about your interests. When you walk into a game store, comic store, music store, gun store, whatever, and the person sitting behind the counter has their magazine and they look up at you and they give you that glare like, oh God, you're interrupting me. And then they go back to their magazine. And unless you engage them,
yeah.
and you happen to bring up a topic that they're specifically interested in and passionate about, you get no response. What they don't do is proactively engage the consumer and try to create an experience that people want to shop with them. It's like Randall said in Clerks, you know, this job would be great if it weren't for all the customers. A lot of people run their game stores that way, where this job would be great if it weren't for all those pesky people who are coming in and trying to give me their money. It's just contradictory.
Some of the game shops or comic shops or whatever shop, hell, I even saw an ice cream shop that failed because of this. The person who opened up the shop was a huge fan of X. Mm-hmm. They're a huge fan of comic books, so they open up a comic book shop.
Right.
They're a huge fan of ice cream, and I actually had this happen down the street from me years and years ago. Loved ice cream. Walked in there, had struck a conversation with the person, new ice cream shop. I just love ice cream, and ice cream's my life, and all this sort of stuff. And they were closed, you know, a month later. Just because you love something does not make you a business person.
Right. What is my love of ice cream? And I can tell you about, you know, how much air has been whipped into it, and what mm-hmm. kind of cream we used, and what temperature it was whipped at, and how it is frozen. But what does that tell me about negotiating a triple net lease?
Yeah.
What does that tell me about my FICA taxes? What does that tell me about my workers' comp liability insurance? What does that tell me about hiring practices? Like, who should I hire? What should I look for? Once I've hired somebody, how should I train them? How many people should be working in my store? How much should I be paying people? What kind of dividends should I be taking out of the company if the company is profitable? Here's a big one. Is the company profitable? What percentage does your payroll run right now? A lot of people out there who run stores like this, they're not business people. They can't tell you. Mm-hmm. If I said, what are your fixed costs? They would look at me and they would think, what are fixed costs? So people come to this industry and they don't give it a sense of legitimacy, and they don't give it the respect like any other business that it deserves. And that's why they fail.
Well, and it seems like they wouldn't even recognize it to hire somebody to help.
Right.
You know, maybe mm-hmm. you can't. Maybe you're like, I am not a business person, so right. I should not be handling this. But you could always find somebody to help you who can.
Yeah. Right. Well,
that's
my
thing.
And that's the interesting thing about Dave as an individual. I didn't know those things. When I started working for the fantasy shop, I worked in the optical industry. And I got a call from a buddy who was managing a store at the time. I worked my way up from being a clerk to being an assistant manager to managing one store to then managing our largest store and now managing the company. But everything that I have learned has been on the job training. It's all been stuff that I've had the luxury of being educated by one of the most knowledgeable people in the industry about the business. In fact, Dave wrote a book called The Specialty Retailer's Handbook, and it's a little dry at points, but it really does a wonderful job of teaching you those lessons of, so what are fixed costs? What kind of space should I look for? What kind of product mix should I have, et cetera?
I want to talk a little bit here about inventory, specifically on the topic of role-playing games. Mm-hmm. If you go back 15 years, you had a handful of giants, relatively speaking here, that dominated the industry. FASA, Playdium, TSR, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. But as it stands right now, while you do still have a handful of really big names, Paizo, WotC, mm-hmm.
MorningSkyStudio.com,
Chad's Pet Project.
Yeah. Shameless plug.
While you do have a handful of things that still stand as these really tall, great big giants mm-hmm. of the industry, once again, relatively speaking, big fish in a small pond,
right?
There is an increasing amount of decentralization in terms of the creation of the role-playing game products. You know, you have all of these smaller companies, sometimes all the way down to a single individual or maybe a duo, who get something going through Kickstarter, who get something out there on drive-through. I mean, occasionally you get a story like somebody like Luke Crane, who has kind of this runaway success, you know, with something like Burning Wheel. But the reality is that right now, with how simple it has gotten to create your own products, even good quality products, and I realize there's a lot of crap out there, but it's also very feasible to make high quality products by using something like Kickstarter, by making connections with artists and layout and writers and whatnot, all these different people online, getting something put out through a print on demand, whatever. How do you guys as a store decide what to stock? Now, I know some of this is inertia. What people buy, right. you buy more of.
Right.
But how do you decide to pick something up, put it on the shelves, and see if it works.
Right. Well, earlier in the episode, I talked about how Dave carried everything because there wasn't a lot available. Nowadays, even though we carry a lot of product, we carry a small amount of what is universally available in any one industry, whether it's collectible card games. I have the group that I carry that I'm successful with. Comic books. There are a lot of comic books that are available that we don't carry, especially a lot of small independent press stuff. A lot of role-playing games, miniature games. It really comes down to, as you said, inertia, I think, is the first thing that I would turn to. But the second thing that I would turn to is, what am I hearing about in my stores? What are people interested in? When the Game Trade magazine comes out every month, or the Meeple Monthly comes out, we'll look through those industry magazines. And if we see something that looks interesting, we'll try to look for its pedigree, like Numenaria from Monty Cook. I heard about that. I got onto Kickstarter and I ordered multiple copies so I could have it for retail in the shops. We do a little bit of research, but we'll hear. I mean, we carried Burning Wheel right from the very beginning because I was a role play guy and it sounded interesting to me and I'd heard some interesting buzz about it. So I wanted to have it on the shelf. We rely very heavily on the employees to feel the pulse of the clientele and the managers to be knowledgeable about what their employees are hearing from clientele. But it also comes down to passion. The St. Charles location moves a lot of Games Workshop stuff, specifically Warhammer 40,000, because one of the employees who's been with the company for 17 years loves Warhammer 40,000 and all of its permutations and does a really good job of promoting the hobby. We're going to get a lot of the new Fate core rulebook in. And its success or failure is going to be contingent upon employees understanding how it works, being passionate about it, and putting it in people's hands. But if I don't have somebody in the store who is able to look at product X and say, this product is interesting and we should carry it and I'm going to be able to sell it and here's why, it often does not get purchased. When I worked in the optical industry, it was very interesting. We would have corporate reps come out and they would do a little seminars, lunches, whatever, and they would have people from a specific optical company come in and they would say, here's our new lens. And this is why this lens, this lineless bifocal is good and why it's superior to the other models. I know the role-playing game industry does not have the money to do this, but actually having somebody in my store to tell me why this game is good or why I should be shelving this game or how I should be promoting this game, what, even if it's sell sheets or retailer pitches, you know, on YouTube that only retailers have access to, something that the manufacturer can do. This is why you, the retailer, should have my game on your shelf. And as gamers, this is why you're going to enjoy it. And as retailers, this is why you're going to sell it. I think would go a long way for people who want to promote something like, I don't know, a Skies of Glass, a Blood Moon Goblins, etc.
I actually have heard, not that I think this is going to go anywhere, but I have heard from time to time these rumblings among the people that produce role-playing games, trying to work out schemes to get some kind of an industry representative that can do that, that can be paid, whether it's by GAM or whomever, to go from store to store and to make these kinds of pushes, to basically do in a game store like, Chad, what your dad did in a grocery store, of going in and saying, hey, you guys need to carry this particular food item, and here's why, and get somebody that would represent that at that level. But let me ask you a question that maybe fits within a paradigm that already is possible. And I'm certainly not asking for a commitment here because I have no product I'm trying to sell. But what if somebody did that locally? Obviously, most game stores are local. There are not many that have locations that stretch across the nation or anything like that. I'm not aware of any big retail chain within the role-playing industry or whatever. I mean, Games Workshop, I realize, has their own chain of stores, but that's really kind of a bizarre exception, is obviously dedicated only to their products.
No comment.
But the point here being, let's say that a local author came in and made that kind of push. Is that something you guys would be receptive to, or is it?
Absolutely. So for example, let's say Creator X comes up with a game and they had a successful Kickstarter, but they don't really know the rigors of distribution. They don't know how to get an account with ACD or Alliance or Peach State or any of the other distributors in the industry, and they want to come to the game store and they want to set up a signing slash game demo. And they would say, hey, I would like to come in on this day. Do you have space available? Would it be okay if I did some demos of a game? Would you guys be interested in selling them? Would it be okay if we sold them and gave you guys a kickback or what have you? I mean, we'll have comic artists come in or comic writers come in to do signings, and we will encourage them to bring in their own product for sale. I won't take any of the money. In fact, we just recently had Joe Harrison for a signing, the writer of Great Pacific, the comic book, and we flew him in. We got him a rental car. We put him up in a hotel, and we encouraged him to bring product to sell himself. All I wanted was for him to be here because a couple of my employees are really, really big fans of his, and we wanted to help promote his book. So I don't even need any sort of financial benefit as a retailer. I benefit by having a name, somebody who's published something in the industry, somebody who's a known factor into that advertises the fantasy shop. So if you don't see other game stores in your town doing that kind of stuff, but you do see one game store doing it, then they're doing it right. Sort of counterpoint to that, if a creator is doing that and reaching out to other game stores, if you have a game and I think it's a neat product and I think I have a market for it in my store and you don't want me to buy it from you, you want me to buy it from a distributor, I'll get my rep on the phone while you're in the shop and say, hey, you know, Chris, Janelle, whomever, I've got this person in the store. They've got this game. This is the publisher. You guys aren't carrying it. And if you did, I'd buy it from you. But instead, I'm going to buy them from him and then say, okay, cool. Talk to you next week. Whatever.
As we wrap this up, let me give you kind of an open-ended question here. What do you think within the immediate future, right now, maybe going into the next 2-3 years, what do you think are the biggest challenges that the retail side of the role-playing industry faces? Specifically the local retail side, not the Amazons or things like that.
If you look at the St. Louis market, it's pretty interesting. There's a lot of competition. If you really look into it, if you make a list of the game stores and the comic stores and then include us in terms of being both comic and gaming stores, but then you have places that are just quote unquote card shops, there's a lot of competition available. But frankly, I think the biggest challenge is going to be something like Kickstarter. And I think it's going to be a challenge not only for retailers, but I also think it's going to be a challenge for distribution because Kickstarter hasn't come up with a solid format yet for involving the retailer or involving the distributor. And let's take Sedition Wars, the miniatures game, for an example. Great miniatures game, brilliant pedigree, wonderful game designer, wonderful game. But I didn't sell it. I got several copies from between my four locations, and we didn't sell any of them because the people that were interested in that game already had it. Why would they come to me and get it? Also, why would I want to market to people who already own a product? Why would I want to promote it by having leagues, by getting peripherals, by getting expansions for it, etc.? I don't need to be involved in the process anymore. So you, the consumer, it's not the same as going to Amazon and buying a product that I also happen to carry. At this point, you're going on to Kickstarter and you're contributing to a project where you're getting the product faster and you're getting more bang for your buck. And as a retailer, I can't get it at any cheaper price than you can. So I can't even make a margin on it. I can't even sell it to break even. I bought it for the same $20 you did, what am I going to sell it for? I'm not going to sell it for 40, especially to people who are already bought it for 20 and got 6 extra bonus supplements because they blew the doors off of their stretch goals. So I would have to say Kickstarter and how Kickstarter is going to affect production. And honestly, if I was a distributor, I'd be concerned because distributors have a much narrower margin than we retailers do. So if the consumer can bypass the retail store and the distribution and the manufacturing can go straight to the consumer, that's great. But how long does that last when people don't have places to hang out and play their games and peruse the shelves and talk to people?
There's other challenges with that. And just looking at the negative aspects of Kickstarter, not the looking at its obvious positive ones, you can go into a gaming store, you can have a conversation with somebody, they can make recommendations, mm-hmm. You can meet people, you can play there and stuff. You can't really do that on Kickstarter. Yeah, they have a comments section, but that's a fire hose. And also, but
that's a very good analogy.
People that make the $1 donation,
yeah, they
just to troll it and then pull that $1
exactly.
donation. Yeah, I've seen a few of those.
And then, you know, if I go into your store and I lay my money down and you hand me a book, you've got your money, I've got my book. Mm-hmm. I go to Kickstarter, I lay my money down, they got my money. And yeah. I wait, and I wait.
And they never meet their goal. Wait,
and, well, they meet their goal, and it's successful, and they just don't produce it. Tough. You know, I've been I was part of a Kickstarter, Mobile Frame Rapid Attack or Mobile Frame Zero. It's basically a Lego miniatures game where he had a lot of problems. A lot of them were legitimate. You know, this was early days of Kickstarter, and they didn't understand having a really overly successful Kickstarter. You're going to have problems with distribution and getting your books out. Problems with the printer. He got the stuff from the printer. All the colors were wrong. He sent them back. He got the books again. They got water damaged in transit. He had to send them back. I mean, it was a nightmare. I mean, it was really tough for this guy. And then, you know, he's trying to send stuff out and it's the addresses were wrong and he's trying to save money. He blew through all the Kickstarter money going through all these hoops. And then he was like going to PAX and stuff and trying to get people. Are you going to PAX? Meet me at this booth. I will give you your book and this will save me money so I don't have to ship it because I am now tearing into my own money. We've blown through all the Kickstarter stuff. And Kickstarter is a whole, we can do a whole time. You know, we have done a whole thing on it of the ups and downs of Kickstarter too.
Right. For me, what's interesting is if Joe Blow puts together a book and he gets $2,000 and he produces his book, great. I may or may not have that guy's book. Monty Cook, well-known name, respected, good game designer, puts together a book. How many people are buying Monty's book from Kickstarter that aren't going to buy it from me? Believe you me, I'm a consumer. I don't begrudge anybody. I get shopping online. I get contributing to Kickstarter. Thank you, Rod Thomas. But Veronica Mars is the greatest television show in the history of human existence. And it's the only Kickstarter I've ever actually given money to for myself. But I think it's great. I just think that it is going to have a pretty severe impact on the future of retail. I mean, what happens when Paizo decides that they're going to do their next Ultimate Magic 2 or Ultimate Equipment 2 or Bestiary 4, and they're going to kickstart it. And we're going to put that book online, and we're Paizo. And we're going to advertise it on DriveThruRPG, and we're going to advertise it on our website, and you're going to be able to get it here first. Now, we're still going to make it available to retail, and we're going to ship it to distributors, so distributors will send it to retail at the exact same time that you, the consumer, are going to get it.
But everybody who wants it has it.
Everybody who wants it has it, and everybody who wants it has it with bonus material that I, as the retailer, don't have.
Well, and then now you're stuck with product.
And it will be interesting to see if that happens.
I would totally do it if I was them.
Well, I don't know that they will, and I certainly don't want to speak on their behalf. They're people who would be much more knowledgeable.
Dan, we're Fear the Boot.
Okay. So,
we are knowledgeable.
Let me go ahead and explain what they're doing.
Yes.
Down to their most intimate thoughts. In fact, right now in Fear the Boot Labs, I'm working on the most powerful and famous role-playing game writer to have ever existed. It's like an M.C. Escher sort of thing. Like, it can't exist in reality. Monty Cook's Monty Cook. Wrap your head around that. All right. But no, I have overheard some of the discussion that goes on among the people that are at the top tier producing role-playing games. I won't name companies or individuals. This is really not my place. But they have talked about that very situation. And there is certainly some reticence on their part to do that because they recognize that to screw the retailers is a very, very short-sighted action. It might give them a big bump on a product, but in the long term, they're biting the hand that feeds, because if they take those local gaming stores, those local communities, those local central hubs of many gaming groups out of the picture, and all of a sudden all of these infrastructures that they've put in place through their play organizations and all that kind of stuff, they do have an understanding they're biting the hand that feeds, and they're ultimately weaving the rope that will become their own noose. Now, will this actually stick true? Who knows? But they do at least have some awareness of the reality of that situation.
And I think there's validity to that. If you look at Hero System, and some people are out there, what happened to Hero System? I don't know exactly all of the reasons why Hero System's not around anymore, but I know that the beginning of the end is when, I forget the gentleman's name who created Hero or owns Hero, basically posted an open letter on the front of his website saying, look, I would really prefer if you bought the book directly from me, as opposed to buying it from retailers because I'm in some financial problems, blah, blah, blah. And I'd really make more money this way. And then a lot of retailers said, okay, great. I'm not going to carry your product anymore. And so there would certainly be backlash. Right. It's kind of the Wild West. We don't know. I mean, how much do they really need us?
Gaming's a cultural tradition.
Right.
I mean, like any cultural tradition, there are places from which you get it. Someone picks it up and then it is passed down socially from game master to group. And then from that group, it's evangelized right. to another group. And if you start to cut those distribution chains out of the picture without a really solid mechanism for organizing and distributing to people instead of the gaming store, mm-hmm. you have effectively just written your own warrant. I mean, right. you just sealed your own doom.
Right. It's interesting, too. I explain this to comic customers. People come in and they look at the shelf and they see all the Marvel books and they pick up a copy of Wolverine. They think that they're giving that money to Marvel. Well, no. That's Dave's comic book. That's Dave's Wolverine. He owns that. He bought that already. We've paid for it. It's on the shelf. It's ours. You're actually buying from Dave. Yeah. I'm Marvel's Salesforce. I'm ultimately putting their product in the hand of the end consumer.
Dave didn't even give the money to Marvel.
Right.
Dave gave it to Diamond.
Diamond gave the money to Marvel. Right. Yep. Right. But what the game industry doesn't understand, or maybe they do and it doesn't matter, it's challenging because I don't think that retailers get a lot of the respect or appreciation that they deserve. Because as you just pointed out, we are the hand that feeds them. If we don't order product, product isn't in stores. If product isn't in stores, it's more challenging for people to go right. out there and find it. And people mm-hmm. will go online and look out specific product, right. but the product that's in stores is the product that sells more, whether it sells online sure. or sells in stores. It's the product that the consumer is aware of.
And what happens if tomorrow game stores start en masse booting Pathfinder Society out of their doors?
Right, because they did a Kickstarter and we were upset.
Precisely. Right. And so I think that recognition is there.
Right.
All right. Well, Mike, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show and talking about this. Like I said, it's been something that I have been wanting to talk about for years, and I'm glad that we finally were able to. You okay over there, Julia? All right.
And I'm sexual Care Bears hit a
train wreck. Just became a train wreck.
Yes,
but anyway,
but Tony Stark is still going strong.
I think my friend has that movie.
So Pat does. But anyway, I want to thank you very much for being on the show because it has been great talking to you about this. And since you're local, I'd like a lot of people to be real easy to follow up with you here in the future as things start to develop.
Yeah, so, not to try to shoehorn myself into the show, I'd love to talk about a gaming topic.
And that's something we can arrange. Yeah. Whenever one of these guys pisses me off, I'll just talk about that.
Right.
They're all disposable to me.
I suspect that it's just like a job at the game store. You probably have a line of people that are waiting to get on the show. Like we have a line of people that are waiting to get a job.
I actually love to make that happen. We will have you back on at some point here just to talk about a gaming topic that has nothing to do with retail whatsoever. In the meantime, if you are in the St. Louis area, visiting the St. Louis area, passing through the St. Louis area, be sure to check out the Fantasy Shop. You can find their locations either just by going onto Google and just looking up the Fantasy Shop and then being sure to kind of sort out the similarly named porn shops. You guys also do have a website, which at least has your locations
on it. fantasyshoponline.com. And if you go into a store and you are not treated well, you get poor service, you don't like the cut of their proverbial jib, give me an email. It's fantasyshopgm@gmail.com.
And if you work at the Fantasy Shop and just heard that, you know that Santa's watching.
They'll tell you that I'm a hateful tyrant. But I'm making Dave money, so that's all that matters.
All righty. Well, thank you very much, Mike, for appearing on the show. As for you guys at home, as always, you have a great week and even greater games. And we will catch you guys next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.